Raymond began. He talked about the size of Saudi's presumed gas reserves and outlined how Exxon might be able to exploit them. Each of the other executives spoke similarly until the circle came around to Noto. Little had changed since Mobil was the smallest partner in Aramco, he joked. He was still the last in line. Saudi Foreign Minister Saud al-Faisal, an enthusiast of Abdullah's plan, sat quietly in the room. He was a favorite of Raymond's and other American oil executives because he was pragmatic, competent, comfortable in the West, and interested in forging new pathways to industrial modernization at home. Also present was the kingdom's oil minister, Ali al-Naimi, a non-royal who had ascended through Saudi Aramco's ranks. Al-Naimi looked on Abdullah's outreach to international corporations with suspicion. The initiative could encroach on the prerogatives of Aramco, which al-Naimi oversaw. As Raymond, Nodo, and other chief executives spoke, al-Naimi looked like he had eaten a sour lemon, one person who attended recalled. To Raymond, there appeared to be very few places on the planet with enough oil and gas resources to make a material difference to the revenue and profit picture of Exxon. Chad was a welcome play, but it was hardly an elephant, as exploration and production geologists called huge oil and gas fields. Raymond could count on one hand the countries with enough proven oil and gas reserves to lift Exxon's equity holdings and address its reserve replacement challenges in a serious way: Russia, Iran, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia. Two of them, Iran and Iraq, were entirely closed off to Western investors. If Saudi Arabia was even hinting at the possibility of reopening its reserves, even if it involved only gas, for now, Exxon had to try to make it work, Raymond believed. The loss of Saudi oil when the royal family nationalized Aramco in 1975 had been a blow to Exxon's oil and gas production volumes from which it had never recovered. The expropriation had followed repeated and phlegmatic negotiations in which Exxon's Clifton C. Garvin Jr. had played a leading role. Not for the first or last time, the Saudis exasperated an American negotiator with their opaqueness, delays, and changing terms. "I have to say I can't figure out what they want," Garvin declared at one stage. "We keep leaving pieces of paper detailing how we can work with them, and they keep asking for more talks." Abdullah's vision now was to allow foreign corporations, such as Exxon, to develop freestanding gas fields in exchange for their commitment to use the gas to fuel industrial projects such as water desalination plants, electricity generation, and petrochemical manufacturing. These multi-billion-dollar projects would create skilled jobs for Saudis while addressing chronic infrastructure and electricity problems in the kingdom. The projects would also allow Saudi Arabia to stop wasting its oil on electricity generation. Most of the world's economies had stopped burning fuel oil to make electricity decades earlier. It was a dirty method and economically irrational because the oil fetched greater sums at refineries where it could be made into gasoline or jet fuel. Saudi Arabia still burned off an astounding 200,000 to 300,000 barrels of oil a day to power its heavily air-conditioned cities, a figure that would soon rise toward 800,000 barrels a day. And that production counted against the kingdom's quota as a member of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries cartel. By using natural gas instead, the kingdom would earn more revenue. ExxonMobil already operated large, profitable refining and chemical plants in the kingdom that it had agreed years earlier to construct and operate in exchange for preferential access to Saudi crude. With this new natural gas opportunity, Lee Raymond could expand and diversify Exxon's existing position in Saudi industry. Saud al-Faisal led the gas negotiations for Abdullah. They proved to be long and complicated. As they dragged on, September 11 became a factor. The attack and its aftermath sowed U.S.-Saudi relations with mutual resentments and mistrust. At night, in their palaces, Faisal and other senior Saudis tuned into American satellite news programming, whose presenters and commentators increasingly seemed to be engaged in anti-Saudi race-baiting. When al-Faisal visited the White House, Bush administration officials, including Raymond's friend Cheney, urged him to take stronger action in response to evidence that Saudi clerics and businessmen were financing al-Qaeda. Al-Faisal had attended Princeton University. It pained and angered him to be spoken to as if he were some sort of double-dealing international criminal. Raymond sympathized with Al-Faisal. The ExxonMobil chairman had been visiting Saudi Arabia since the early 1970s and had come to know Al-Faisal well. He shared the Bush administration's outrage over the September 11 attacks, but increasingly he felt uneasy about the hard line taken by Cheney. Raymond told colleagues he feared that an American overreaction could destabilize the Persian Gulf region. The Bush administration seemed not to understand, in particular, the importance of the Sunni-Shia sectarian divide, Raymond said. Saudi Arabia's Sunni royal family lived in deep anxiety about the expansionary ambitions of Iran's Shia-led revolutionary government. There was a restive Shia population within Saudi Arabia, and Iraq's people were mostly Shia. If the region were destabilized, Iran might emerge stronger. In any event, after September 11, there seemed to be a widening gap between how the Saudis analyzed the region's challenges. They placed a strong emphasis on the sectarian issue and Iran, and the way the Bush administration saw them, intently focused as it was on Al-Qaeda and global terrorism. As Raymond and his colleagues negotiated for access to Saudi Arabian gas reserves, ExxonMobil found itself straddling the chasm that opened between Washington and the Saudi regime. Its executives believed Al-Faisal to be a reliable friend and partner of the West, but also a realist about the Middle East. As it became clear that the Bush administration intended to invade Iraq against Saudi advice, Al-Faisal told his anxious ExxonMobil colleagues, "Why would I worry? It's inevitable. There's nothing I can do." Abdullah appointed ExxonMobil as the lead partner in two of the three gas projects he initially approved. Abdullah staged a ceremony in Jeddah for about 300 people, at which the Crown Prince, resplendent in robes, held court to congratulate the ExxonMobil team. Mabruk,